This week on Texas Scorecard Radio in the news, the fight in DFW to save a 9-month-old baby's life as hospital officials seek to pull the plug, plus which lawmakers are backing the Lone Star agenda, and we'll hear about the Democrats' newest lawsuit to make Texas elections less secure. In our interview, we talked to Charles Blaine with Urban Reform about the Houston mayoral runoff and what we can all learn from it, and we'll end with a guest commentary from former state rep Matt Rinaldi on how we can reform the office of Texas House Speaker. Welcome back to this week's episode of Texas Scorecard Radio. I'm your host, Tony McDonald, coming to you from the 1836 Studios in Austin, Texas. You can find us on the web at www.texasscorecard.com. Wanted to get started with this week's top news. Go up to Ross Kessig, Empower Texans president. Big story that was going on over the past weekend involving a young baby that was at risk of being removed from life support and conservative activists kind of mobilizing to stop it. Tell us what was going on up in DFW.
Thanks, Tony. So Tinsley Lewis is a 9-month-old child who is currently on life support through a ventilator. She is not brain dead. She is responsive and conscious. But the hospital at Cook Children's Hospital up in the Metroplex had made the decision to end life support. And under law, Texas state law, they're only required to give the family 10 days notice. And of course, the mother and family did not want to stop providing care and were scrambling to try to buy more time to get their daughter transferred to a facility that would provide care.
Yeah, this is really shocking. People in Texas think, oh, we're a very pro-life state, but we have this 10-day law that's on the books. And we've done a lot talking on the program about efforts by pro-life groups, Texas Right to Life primarily, pushing to get rid of this 10-day law. But here we had a hospital that's not a, you know, not a person who's in a vegetative state or something like that, but a child who just needs help breathing, that being taken away or would have been taken away if not for an outcry from local activists calling the hospital and getting involved.
Right. So Texas Right to Life put out a call to action, and Texans from across the state called the hospital, emailed the hospital administrator, and a couple state representatives, Tony Tinderholt and Tan Parker, physically went to the hospital to meet with staff and try to intervene and buy more time. And they were trying to do everything they could to convince the hospital, you know, not to stop, not to take Tinsley off life support and to allow the family time to transfer the child to another facility. So you actually had lawmakers intervene and physically go to the facility and plead with the administrative staff to not do what unfortunately they are able to do under current law. And again, this was a legislative priority of Texas Right to Life. Lawmakers during this last session did not change the law. They did not fix this problem. And this is very concerning. It's been an eye-opening experience for a lot of Texans who didn't realize that we even had such laws like that.
Yeah, that's right. Now, good news is there's been a reprieve, a conservative judge there in Tarrant County issuing a temporary restraining order. And so this child will have at least a couple of weeks before a hearing.
Tarrant County Judge Alex Kim did sign a temporary restraining order to buy more time until the child can be transferred to another facility.
We'll keep an eye on it. Thanks for your reporting on it, Ross.
Thanks, Tony.
Next, let's turn to Brandon Walton's managing editor for Texas Scorecard. Brandon, there's growing support both from the grassroots and now finally getting some support from lawmakers for this Lone Star agenda. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the Lone Star agenda, essentially after this last legislative session, which a lot of folks calling a purple session where Democrats seem to have more success than Republicans, you've got a group of grassroots folks from across the state, a big list, about 300 people, signed on to pass this package of conservative reforms, conservative priority reforms. There's 11 of them. And they're calling on Governor Abbott right now to call a special session so that they can pass those ahead of the primary election and give conservative voters something to go to the polls for.
Well, and there's been kind of a shot in the arm to this after Texas House Speaker Dennis Bonin decided that he would retire, announce his retirement from the legislature amongst controversy. People saying, hey, not only do we need to have some stuff to campaign on to say these are the things that, you know, Republicans do and deliver for voters, but hey, we need a clean slate. We need something, you know, not this scandal to talk about. We need something fresh.
Yes, exactly. And a great opportunity, right, to not only give them something new to talk about, some new stuff to go home and campaign on, but you also look also from a practical sense of a lot of folks say they want to get rid of Bonin, who's announced that he's retiring. He's not going to run for re-election, but a lot
still
of folks,
the speaker.
A lot of, still the Speaker of the House, still you know, has the potential to taint the Republican ticket going into November of 2020. And so what better opportunity right now for Republicans statewide, especially for Governor Greg Abbott, who has the authority to call the special session, to call them back and get rid of that that open question? Because we know that the Democrats, you know, they're going to use that almost certainly in November.
Now, the grassroots calling for action, calling for legislators basically to pick a side. Are you for the Lone Star Agenda? Are you for a special session? Are you against it? So what are we seeing? Are we actually seeing any legislators sign on to this program, or is it just a grassroots thing?
Well, you've started to see a lot of lawmakers start to trickle out. You've got State Senator Bob Hall, who's been out with a statement, Jonathan Stickland, a House representative who's been out there since the beginning. And then you've got more. You've got James White, Steve Toth, Kyle Biederman. You've got some interesting folks like Dwayne Burns, Angie Chin Button, and Hugh Shine, who reportedly have said they are specifically opposed to the special session for the Lone Star Agenda. But I think the most interesting thing we've seen is that you had Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick sending out a long email in which he said, essentially, you know, the Senate passed a lot of this stuff, put some blame on the House, and then said, interestingly, that it wouldn't be appropriate for him to ask Governor Abbott for a special session, even though he did exactly that just 2 years ago.
So you have some who are supporting it, and then obviously others commenting on it or saying, oh, well, I would support these ideas or these issues if there's a session, but maybe they're not really being clear about whether they actually support the session.
Right. And so we'll see. I know that the folks behind this and the grassroots that really want to see this happen, want to see the special session happen before the primary, are calling their lawmakers and they're making their voices heard. And we'll see. Ultimately, the responsibility comes down to Governor Abbott.
Well, we'll keep an eye on it, and thank you for your reporting on it, Brandon.
Thank you.
Finally, let's turn and talk to Aaron Anderson up in the DFW Metroplex. Aaron, you're kind of our resident expert on election reform, and one of the big reforms this most recent session was getting rid of rolling polling, but now the Democrats are filing suit trying to bring it back. Tell us about it.
Well, that's right, Tony. This is actually just one of several lawsuits that Democrats in the state of Texas and nationwide are filing against voting processes that they think disadvantage Democrats. In this case, rolling polling, which we have talked about for several sessions, is the practice of, also called mobile voting, moving polling stations from place to place during the early voting period, maybe just for a day. So granting really an advantage access-wise to select voters where these mobile sites go, and disadvantaging other voters who you know don't know because it's not at a steady polling place. So it's really kind of selecting specific voters, and something that was really abused by certain local government entities like school districts trying to pass bonds or tax increases.
We would see this where you would have bond elections, the local district trying to get votes for the bond election, and of course they would bounce. You know, they'd be, oh well, early voting location is going to be on Tuesday at Campus A, it's Wednesday at Campus B, and trying to round up all of the votes and the constituencies that have a pecuniary interest in the bond to vote for it. And so lawmakers finally kind of listened to activists, grassroots, who said, hey, this is really unfair to voters. They don't come to my house, right? This is unfair.
Exactly.
And they came in and finally did something about it. But now, of course, the Democrats are trying to undo that reform.
Right. So what the Democrats are claiming is that this is unfair, unconstitutional age discrimination, because it's now somehow making it harder for college students to vote. Because some of these rolling polling places were on college campuses. So there'd be a day or two at this campus, a day or two at that campus. But again, most Texans don't have a polling place roll up right to their door for a day or two. That's their theory, because they obviously feel, Democrats at the state and national level, feel that college students are more likely to vote for Democrats. Therefore, they're trying to push to get extra polling places where they think there are voters favorable to them. And that's how the process has been abused and why the state shut it down, not for any reason to try to disadvantage students or young voters.
Yeah, they're trying to have an equal playing field for all voters. Well, we'll have to keep an eye on it. Obviously, this lawsuit, one of many across the country, and we'll have to keep an eye on it and see what happens, whether we'll be able to retain this reform about rolling polling. Thanks for your reporting on it.
Thanks, Tony.
Texas Scorecard Radio is a project of Empower Texans. At texasscorecard.com or empowertexans.com, you can find more news and daily updates from all around the Lone Star State. You can also find updates from Empower Texans and Texas Scorecard on Facebook and Twitter, and follow Empower Texans on Instagram. Texas Scorecard's News Digest goes out weekly via email and monthly in print. Subscribe online and find more information at empowertexans.com. Someone's always keeping score. We think it ought to be the taxpayers.
Well, it's great to welcome back on the program this week Charles Blaine with Urban Reform. Charles, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. It's been an exciting few weeks, so I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, well, Charles, so you've got this organization. It's a relatively new group based in Houston, pushing, you know, conservative, common sense policy solutions in that urban environment. And obviously, right now, one of the biggest political issues that's going on in Texas is the runoff election between Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner and Houston businessman Tony Busby. Tell us about that. I want to talk about that race. I think it's interesting, not only to voters in Houston, but to people around the state. This is, you know, one of the biggest cities in the world, so certainly very impactful to our economy. I wanted to talk about the personalities and the race there, sure, but talk about some of the issues that we're seeing in that race, what we can learn about, you know, what's going on in the urban environment, and take away from that from a leadership standpoint.
Yeah, so it's definitely been interesting and really fun to watch up close and personal. We started off with about 12 candidates at the beginning of this election cycle, obviously knowing we were going to go into a runoff with the top two. Collectively, all the candidates have spent something around $14 million at this point. So yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how much we spend during these last 32 days. But what has been the most interesting part, I think, is what you just mentioned, is that, you know, especially in our cities, we often talk about, you know, Democrats always win and it's all about the personality and the elected official and things like that. But really what we've seen a lot of in this campaign has been people actually cared about the issues for once. It wasn't just, you know, the personality that they were going after or things like that, because, you know, there was mudslinging left and right. Most of it aimed at our incumbent mayor, Sylvester Turner's challenger, Tony Busby. He was getting it from, you know, the candidates to his right and the candidates to his left. But people still enjoyed what he was saying, because he was talking about things like corruption and giving just concrete examples of corruption and pay-to-play that he's finding in City Hall.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about Sylvester Turner. Talk about kind of some of the issues that came up with his, you know, term as mayor and that his critics were kind of negative on.
Yeah, I mean, where do we even begin? So one of the big issues that played a huge role and just kind of persisted throughout this campaign was this issue where we were passing, well, the city council was passing, approving the receiving of federal funds for flooding. So they were getting FEMA dollars. They had to just kind of approve it as more of just kind of a rubber stamp kind of thing, saying, yes, we'll take it and we're going to use it for projects. A little bit down the road, the tranche of money gets sent to our, you know, public works department and our housing department to figure out how to disperse it. And it comes back to council for approval of projects. And what they find built in there now is $6.7 million going to our mayor's former law partner. So this a bunch of questions came up. Everybody's like, why is the mayor's former law partner, which I think his firm has maybe one or two people, why are they getting paid roughly $7 million to do community outreach services? And it, unfortunately, it
community outreach apparently is important to stopping floodwaters.
Exactly. That's the primary concern that we have when it comes to stopping floodwaters. But you know, Busby, as well as many of the other candidates, made that just a premier issue. I mean, they just hit it repeatedly, talking about how this just is one more instance in a long trend of instances of the mayor, you know, helping out his buddies and things like that. We saw a similar example kind of closer towards the end of the general election cycle, where there was this internship that came to light that was created out of thin air. And it was a few emails between the director of the airport and like the director of public works, where it said, the mayor said, we need an internship for one of this guy named Marvin Agamagu, who's a confidant of the mayor, if you will. And so they created this internship, $95,000 a year. At the end of the internship, the guy gets the luxury of deciding if it becomes a full-time job or not. Not the airport, not HR, no one else, but he gets to decide.
The employee gets to decide. Well, that's an interesting internship.
Exactly. And then days before the election, so this started happening maybe a month before the election, then days before we find out that not only did he get this internship, but it included $35,000 worth of travel. I mean, he went all across the world on what they called learning experiences so he could figure out how to do his job in the airport system. And when questions came up, the mayor's team responded by saying, well, yeah, airport employees travel on airplanes, so what do you expect?
So they just tried to play this thing off. How much, I recall the guy was being paid a lot of money for an intern. It wasn't, you know, oh, here's a little stipend. It was a significant salary.
$95,000. Yeah, huge salary. I mean, I think someone did the analysis, and it was roughly, he was paid, I think it was like 90, higher than 90% of employees for the city of Houston. So the city has about 22,000 employees. Most of them are making probably between $30,000 and $40,000. And so he was getting paid more than 90% of the employees of the city of Houston from this job that was created out of nowhere without any experience.
Now, so Sylvester Turner comes in as mayor, lots of cronyism and corruption. That's a major issue. Obviously, fast forwarding to election night, you have this wide field. He doesn't get, you know, more than half of the vote, which is traditionally a very tough sign for a reelection of an incumbent.
Yeah. And that's the thing. Going into that, he did say, and a lot of the analysts said that there was a possibility of him winning without a runoff. And I think he started to believe that himself. But what's interesting is that he didn't. And it, what makes it more interesting is that you had two solid, they didn't consider themselves Republican, but right of center candidates running against him, who were truly splitting the vote for each other. It was Tony Busby and then former mayoral candidate Phil King, who ran in 2015. So, you know, they both have a lot of name ID. They both have a solid base of support that skews further to the right than Turner's, of course. And they were splitting the vote, and that yet Turner still couldn't oust the two of them without going into a runoff. And so I think where I'm seeing some of that come from is the fact that a lot of these accusations weren't just hollow accusations being made by opponents. They weren't just, you know, campaign rhetoric. A lot of times they pointed to just hardcore evidence that showed that there is pay to play and there's cronyism. And sure, a lot of people expect that in government, but this was taken to a new level where it's just really, really bad. And it's beginning to, you know, impact core services and certainly take them astray from what they should be doing at city council on a weekly basis and really disrupting what government should be doing. And I think people saw that and really believed it and, you know, got convinced by the evidence, and that showed as a result on election night.
Well, so to give people a little bit of context, so you have Turner getting, approximately 48% of the vote on election night, and so that's going to a runoff election. Traditionally, when we look at Harris County and look at Houston, you know, and Houston is not coterminous with Harris County, but it's a useful comparison. When you look at Houston and Harris County, this is an area that over the last few election cycles, now Democrats are winning handily. So you would assume if Democrat voters were just going to support the more liberal candidate, Turner should have just run away with this.
Well, exactly. I mean, and with the amount of money he spent, the endorsements that he had from, you know, lawmakers, his former colleagues, city council members, pastors in the African American community, and just, I mean, he had a wide array of support just coming from so many different areas. The unions were behind him by and large. The one that wasn't was the firefighters union. And so you would think that for that base, if what we have come to know was actually true, they would have just swept him right back in and ignored his challengers, particularly because the mayor started running ads against his challenger, Tony Busby, using pictures of him during the 2016 general election when Tony had supported President Trump. So he thought that that was going to be kind of a death knell and really just started hitting him with, you know, associating him with Trump, saying his rhetoric was like Trump, using pictures. I mean, the whole nine yards, assuming that he could split this down party lines. But I think what it goes to show is that when you have solid policy that's rooted in, you know, principle and values, and you push that forward and you call out the bad things that we see in government, regardless of what party a lot of the base falls in, they're going to go with that good side, with that solid policy, you know, whether it's rooted in conservatism, free markets, you know, they're going to see that and see the benefit of that and give support to that. And I hope we can continue to see that.
Yeah, well, and of course, people have just a very negative reaction to the kind of cronyism that you've discussed. People don't, you know, even Democrats, nobody likes the idea of politicians profiting from their offices or their brother-in-law or their law partner or their friends profiting. I thought another interesting takeaway, obviously, we just had the constitutional amendment elections and Prop 4 to ban an income tax passed handily across the state. But of course, in the urban areas, it underperformed the state average, but still did quite well. You looked at Dallas County and I think Bexar County, most of the major urban counties, it doing about 65% support to ban an income tax. And what was interesting to me is on the same election night that you had big turnout in Houston, and you see Sylvester Turner get 48% of the vote, this same group here voted 65% basically to support a ban on an income tax. So you almost look at that, you go, even the people who voted for Sylvester Turner, there's a good 10% of the electorate that voted for him, but voted to ban an income tax. I think that's really interesting.
It is. It really is. And especially because, you know, I was at the polls a lot and I was talking to, you know, the people who kind of stand out and hang out at the polls are usually politicos one way or the other. So I was talking to some of them and they were, the Democrats there were very opposed to this, saying, oh, it's just a political maneuver. This is stupid. Or, and some of them went as far as to advocate for a state income tax, saying we need more revenue. But yet, the policy did not sell to the average voter, left or right. I think they saw through that and saw that, no, we don't need a state income tax. That is bad. Look at places like New Jersey. I can say that. You know, so I think that really sold to people that we didn't need that. And I mean, even our local paper, the Houston Chronicle, wrote an editorial piece about how this is just political maneuvering. And, you know, I think the narrative there was that Republicans are losing the state, so they're trying to do things like this to save themselves. But no, I think people really saw through a lot of the rhetoric. And again, I think it goes back to that point that good policy often wins the day. And just, I hope that continues, that trend continues.
Well, I think it's really important that we continue to not only as Texans who are concerned about the direction of our state, as our state urbanizes, the population grows, people are moving to cities, and it's important that we don't just give ground in these urban areas and say, oh, well, that's just for the Democrats. Well, then that means that Texas is for the Democrats. That's what, you know, people would be conceding. So, it's really important that we keep an eye on these things. You're on the front lines there in Houston with this work. Tell folks, we're kind of running out of time, tell people how they can connect with you with urban reform and how they can get involved in the work that you're doing there in Houston.
Sure, yeah. Well, you can check out the website, urbanreform.org. We're always putting new videos and editorial content up there for you to read, and I'd love feedback on there. You can use the contact form to get in touch with me or just find me on Twitter, Facebook, or email me. My name's Charles Blaine, charles@urbanreform.org. I'm really easy to find, so would love to hear from anyone who is in Houston or not in Houston and just interested in this kind of work.
Well, appreciate the work you're doing. Very interesting to hear about the things that are going on down there. Keep it up.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
It's that time of year again, time for Empower Texans' annual Conservative Leaders Gala. The Conservative Leaders Gala, or CLG, happens each December in Irving, Texas, and is a time for celebration and fellowship with members of the grassroots from the far reaches of the Lone Star State. One night where we all come together and honor the hard work done by everyday Texans to ensure Texas' Lone Star shines a little brighter. As we've done every year, 12 awesome activists will be honored in front of the crowd and be awarded engraved cavalry swords, symbolizing their role on the front lines of the fight for freedom. So RSVP today at empowertexans.com/events and join us at the Conservative Leaders Gala December 7th in Irving, Texas.
With the retirement of Texas House Speaker Dennis Bonin, we're now looking at another speaker's race headed into the next legislative session. In this week's guest commentary, former State Rep Matt Rinaldi talks about why it's important that lawmakers not only change out personalities, but look at reforms to the office of speaker itself.
Our American experiment is based on the notion that rights are God-given and must be protected. Our founders recognized the inherent sinful nature of mankind threatened those rights when government became too powerful. And too powerful certainly describes the office of Speaker of the Texas House. Hi, I'm former State Representative Matt Rinaldi with the Texas Scorecard Radio guest commentary. The insight of our founders is evident to anyone following the recent news involving Texas House Speaker Dennis Bonin, who recently announced his intent to leave office after being implicated in a scandal involving dishonesty and influence peddling. Bonin's conduct was not surprising, especially in a system that has evolved to give the speaker power far in excess of what Texas's founders intended. Traditionally a ministerial position, it was more common prior to 1977 for there to be multiple speakers in a single legislative session than there was for a speaker to serve more than one session. It wasn't until 1979 that Texas saw its first three-term speaker in Bill Clayton. The speaker position as it exists now is extremely powerful. He has total discretion in appointing committee chairs, largely controls the makeup of committees, and has full control over the most powerful procedural committees. By appointing only his most trusted allies to those positions, the speaker has almost absolute control over what legislation reaches the floor and is passed. This level of concentrated power has not had positive results. Of the five speakers since Clayton, two have stepped down amidst legal and ethical questions. Texas has now had three consecutive Texas House speakers who have been widely criticized for wielding power in an authoritarian manner. The position of Speaker of the Texas House should be returned to what it once was, just a few decades ago. A series of reforms would provide important checks on future speakers to better ensure the office is less likely to be abused and to allow our Texas-elected representatives to have more control. These include, one, speaker term limits. Limiting each speaker to one term, as Florida does currently, would significantly reduce the power of the office. A speaker serving one term has significantly less leverage when the members know a new session will bring a fresh start. Two, rotating chairmanships. We should limit committee chairmanships to two consecutive terms. Three, transparency in committee selection. The committee selection process gives too much discretion to the speaker, even for seniority positions, and it's done behind closed doors. Members should exercise their seniority in an open process. Number four, direct floor access for bills. The speaker has too much power to kill popular legislation by stalling it in procedural committees. A bill should automatically go to the floor for a vote if more than two-thirds of the chamber co-authors it. Five, seniority picks for procedural committees. Currently, the speaker picks 100% of the membership of procedural committees. Allowing seniority picks for these powerful committees would provide more transparency in the legislative process and allow members outside the speaker's inner circle more influence over legislation. Our founders recognized that man's sinful nature necessitated that no one person should have too much power in our Republican system of government. If the Bonin saga has proven anything, it's that our speaker position has become too powerful. These five reforms would make the speaker's position less powerful, less susceptible to corruption, and provide better policy results for Texans. With a Texas Scorecard Radio guest commentary, I'm Matt Rinaldi.
Well, that's all I have for you this week. One last note, if you haven't registered yet for the Empower Texans Conservative Leaders Gala, December 7th in Irving, please go on to empowertexans.com/events, register for that. I'd love to see all of your smiling faces. Thanks for listening.
Texas Scorecard Radio is brought to you each week as a public service from the Empower Texans Foundation and in partnership with the Lincoln Institute and this station. You can download podcasts from each program and learn more at empowertexans.com.